This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is William Powers, a writer, speaker, and expert on sustainable development and the global slow movement. William is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and an adjunct faculty member at New York University. William Powers is here today to tell us about his most recent book, New Slow City, Living Simply in the World's Fastest City. Welcome.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to be here.
What is your purpose in writing New Slow City?
Well, what happened was my wife and I were both feeling so tied into the dominant kind of work and spend treadmill and, you know, working long hours, not having enough free time for the things that we love to do, and also the sense that we're part of this global environmental crisis. And in some ways, by being stressed out and consuming more to relieve that stress and so on, we're just part of the problem. So what happened is we decided to do a big change in our lives in New York City. And we downsized from a 1,900-square-foot townhouse in Queens to a 350-square-foot micro-apartment. That's 20% of the size of our original house. And we got rid of 80% of our belongings. And basically, also, I downscaled my work to 20 hours a week from being kind of a workaholic. And that was also to allow a dividend of free time for creativity and for just feeling better.
In your book, you talk about urban slow, and I think you've started alluding to it, but what is urban slow?
Well, you know, just to give a little background on that, I mean, I lived for a season in a 12-foot by 12-foot cabin off-grid, and that's where I wrote my book 12 by 12 about that experience. And in some ways, like a lot of my readers and in interviews and so on, they said, well, it's fine to be able to live that slow, calm lifestyle in a 12-foot-12 cabin, but what about like in the city where most of us have to live because of jobs and so on? So in some ways, it was applying what I learned in the 12-by-12 to the urban environment. So what it really is practicing kind of a contemplative way of life wherever you are. So we developed a bunch of tools that we'd use in Manhattan, like living at the third story, where instead of just being at the street level, you suddenly can look up and see like the beautiful glints on a baby grand piano through a window or some of the trees above, and you're outside of the consumer space and up there at a higher level. The other is having, you know, a yoga or meditation practice, which is extremely helpful, and also looking for urban sanctuaries, you know, those beautiful spaces that you can find anywhere. For us, for example, it was the edge of Pier 45 in the West Village in Manhattan at the very end, where you can't hear the highway anymore, and it's just like this peaceful sound of the water lapping up on it, you know. And we also take silent meals together, and even in restaurants, where we just appreciate the soundscape and each other's presence and so on. So what I did find is, like, you know, you really can live a more peaceful life wherever you are.
So for you personally, what do you see as the key advantages of urban slow?
Well, I mean, for one thing, the levels of stress are incredible in our society. It's one of the biggest killers in terms of healthcare. And, you know, there's a term in Japan, karoshis, you know, people who die from overwork. Even as labor has become three times as efficient in the U.S. since the 1970s, our work hours have gone up by something like 40%. So even though we're producing a lot more per hour, why do we keep working more? Where does it end? So the benefits of it are, one, for your health, just feeling better, having more time with your family, with your partner, to do things that you love to do. And the other is more ecological. You know, the way to be more green is to slow down, because you're kind of consuming less, you're less prone to be tied to the dominant mentality out there, which is work long hours and spend the money.
In addition to being more green, are there additional advantages for society or the community?
Well, definitely, because if you picture the way things are going right now with, you know, Google, as you know, is not just a company that has a search engine, it's an artificial intelligence company. Now there's the Google Glasses, and the next thing is going to be the chip in the brain, per their own mission statement, if you read it. So in a sense, for society, like slowing down and finding your inner voice, kind of a sense of peace with yourself, I think we're less likely to go down these dangerous technological roads. And I'm not a Luddite by any means, you know, and slow does not mean being Luddite or rejecting technology. It just means that technology should be your tool and you shouldn't be its fool. So in a sense, we want to make sure that these labor-saving devices are actually saving labor for us instead of the current reality. Now, if you look at, like, smartphone use, for example, some 80% of Americans check smartphones under the table during dinner. And the workday is really extended to 13 and a half hours if you count the time that people are checking email when they first wake up and then right before they go to bed and everything in between. So flex time has kind of become all the time. And to just get back some of our creativity and passion for life and connection to others, like interconnection, you know, not this bowling alone society where it's just individuals, but rather this higher context community life that, you know, America had in the past. So the slow life has a deep kind of philosophical benefit.
Would you say more about the small apartment you moved into and how you adapted to living in a smaller space?
Right, that's a great question, because at first it was sort of like slam dancing in a little mosh pit, because it's this tiny apartment. It's basically like two 12 by 12s put together. And my wife and I were bumping into each other, banging our shins against the bed edge and so on. And just to take a bath in this tiny bathtub, you had to do the yoga posture shoulder stand with your feet kind of up the wall to get into this tiny tub. But what we realized after a while was really that less is more, in a sense. And we decided to equip it like you would a little ship, a boat, something like that. And it's appropriate because, you know, Manhattan is surrounded by two rivers, the East River and the Hudson, kind of like sailing through Manhattan, this tiny boat. And we just had the perfect amount of stuff in each place. And we just got rid of another purge, some more stuff. And what we found was like our happiness kind of increased to the amount that we shed. Not only were we able to clean the apartment in 7 minutes, and there was never any clutter because everything had its exact space and couldn't be more than 4 feet away from where it belonged, you know. But we also began to live outside of our apartment. It forces you to be in the public spaces, like Central Park and Washington Square Park, and out in cafes and so on. So by not having this huge personal individual space, you're kind of forced into collective spaces.
Would you say more about how you took back your time or created more time for yourself?
Well, I actually applied two related principles. One was 80-20, which means that you accomplish 80% of your results in 20% of the time. And likewise, we tend to squander 80% of our time on just 20% of the results. So I realized that by focusing on certain work activities, I was able to, even though I reduced my work hours to 20 hours a week, I was able to just get a lot more productivity done in that time. And then the second principle I applied was the Hutchinson's principle, which is that work expands to fill the amount of time you give it. So I set myself really short deadlines on those 20% of activities that yielded the most results, and therefore I was much more effective.
What are some of the ways you spent the time that you freed up?
Well, you know, at first we were going to a lot of free things. It was part of the experiment, you know, like gallery openings, and there's 200 yoga studios and you can get free yoga classes wherever. But then I realized that was kind of a selfish approach to just looking for all the free things you could do. So, you know, what we started doing was also volunteering. You know, there's a big gap in how much time we're actually able to give to civic activities because we're so busy with our paid work. But I was able to start working on the country's biggest rooftop organic farm, Brooklyn Grange, as a volunteer, and also with 350.org, a climate change activist group, and so on, and also with my students at NYU on some of the student debt campaigns. So it freed me up to like have more service. And the other thing that I would do is just spend a lot of time doing, well, absolutely nothing. I think that there's three things in life. You know, there's having, being, and doing. And in America, we're really good at, you know, having a lot of stuff and doing. We're great at that. But what about being? You know, in most societies throughout history, whether it's medieval Europe, which, by the way, the average medieval peasants worked significantly less than we do today, or even hunter-gatherer and subsistence agriculturalists today all around the world work a lot less. And what I've noticed, because I've actually traveled and worked in some 60 countries around the world, is that there's a leisure ethic around the world, not just a work ethic that we have in our like highly puritanical, very laissez-faire capitalist society. And what that translates into in daily life is like 3 or 4 hours a day sitting on the porch in a lot of these cultures, or playing soccer for hours and hours, or the siesta culture, which is common around the world. So I started to cultivate some of that being aspect in Manhattan, and sometimes it just meant going out to the edge of Pier 45 and just sitting there, reading haiku and looking out over the river, or going to the Chinese decorative arts part of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, this hidden corner up in the third story there and just enjoying the art for a leisurely amount of time.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is William Powers, author of the book, New Slow City, Living Simply in the World's Fastest City. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How did you go about practicing slow food during your year in New York, and what did you learn?
Well, Diana, as you know, that there are slow food conviviums all throughout the country. There's something like 500 of them. And, you know, Slow Food USA is a wonderful organization, and it's great to get involved with it. We personally focus more on slow food in terms of just being more mindful of our own eating. So we would usually go to like one restaurant a week. We'd look forward to it, what I call cultivating anticipation. You know, we're going to go to this place and have this wonderful meal together. And then just focus on all of your senses when you're eating. Okay, so like the sound of the silverware clinking, other tables around you, and the taste of the food and the smell of it and so on, just chewing the food a lot. And then at home also, like, you know, we'd buy everything from the local farmers markets as much as possible. We were growing some stuff in a garden and just trying to appreciate as much as possible local food. Then the other aspect of slow food for us was exploring the diversity of food in Manhattan. So we'd bike all around and sometimes take the Staten Island Ferry over to Staten Island and find like this Liberian neighborhood there and just get some great Liberian food. You know, because New York is just a place with so many cultures, and by having all the free time also, we were able to take the time to bike places and find these new spots.
When you found out that you and Melissa were going to have a baby, what did you see as the challenges of having a baby in the context of your slower lifestyle?
Well, there's a number of things. One thing is, you know, even while our daughter Clay was still in uterus, we received a gift card for Bye Bye Baby, the corporate chain. And of course, I went right to the store and asked for a refund, which they wouldn't give me. But, you know, automatically when you're starting a family, you're going even stronger into the dominant ethos, you know, of work and spend and this kind of all-pervasive consumerism in our society. So that was one aspect of it, like, wow, we can't be as independent thinkers and doing things as alternatively, because when you get into the family pattern, there's that whole level of interconnection to society. The other thing is, fitting a child also into this tiny micro apartment was going to be a challenge, of course. So all of those things we struggled with quite a bit. You know, there's the slow parenting movement, which is all about not helicopter parenting, giving kids a lot more free space. It's about limits on gadget use and screen time. And by the way, the average screen time for a child in the U.S. is 7 hours a day, you know, all the different types of screens they're involved with, and so forth. So that's a powerful movement.
In your book, you speak about consumerism and how we are manipulated to have certain wants. Would you share your direct personal experience of attempts by companies to manipulate both the hipsters on the subway promoting the latest game and also the employees that were paid to offer free samples during ordinary social interactions?
Right. So in Manhattan, people become basically immune to most of the advertising, or it's, of course, it's affecting you subconsciously, but the advertisers are always looking for new ways to get at you. So the new type of advertising that we experienced was called stealth advertising. And what you're alluding to is one time on the subway, actually, I overheard two young hipsters talking about a new product. It was a video game. And I was a little bit suspicious about this conversation. It sounded a little bit sort of forced, and everyone was hearing what they were saying about this cool new game. So I followed them, and they went to the next subway car, and they had the same conversation again right there for like another 50 people to hear. And they were paid, basically, to go from car to car and talk about this video game. So it probably hit, you know, 500 people an hour with this message coming from, like, trendsetters. So I actually confronted them about it on the subway. I said, hey, you guys are just going from car to car. And they're like, no, we weren't. And they just denied it, got off. And I was the crazy one. So in other words, the space of human interaction has become commercialized, ordinary human interaction, and the space of overhearing. And for myself, for saying, wait a minute, no, that space should be non-commercialized, I was sort of ostracized by the other passengers on the subway.
And would you also talk about the employees that were paid to offer free samples to people during ordinary social interactions?
I know, that was when I was in Greenwich Village one evening, and you know, this attractive young woman came up to me, and you know, she said, oh, I like your hat, or I like your scarf, she said. Oh, thanks, you know. And we started talking, and then just like, yeah, you know, do you like tea? And it turns out she was promoting, I'm not going to mention the name to advertise it more, but a tea chain store in New York. And basically, she gets bonuses for whenever somebody comes in to the shop and asks for the tea based upon her referral. So even in her free time, she was working to sell the tea.
Would you tell us about Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping?
Okay, well, Reverend Billy is a wonderful figure in New York. And basically, it's this gorgeous choir of people, like very good singers, and he's dressed up as a reverend. He's not really a reverend, and then it's the choir, and they go around and they sing about resisting consumerism. And one time when I saw them in Washington Square Park, they actually exercised a Starbucks cup. So some guy walked by with a Starbucks cup, and they actually exercised it. In the end, the guy smashed it under his foot. The idea is that New York is so full of diverse coffee shops, and they're being pushed out by some of the global chains.
What was your experience with slow travel?
Slow travel is a reaction to package tours and through just like creating an itinerary, like almost like you would do a stamp collection. It's more about lingering in a place, sinking in, and the same contemplative idea I was talking about in a city you do while you're traveling. So like the way I practice it was when I went to Morocco for a work trip, and I just thought, I'm going to spend 2 more weeks just in Morocco. I had no guidebook, no idea where I was going. I just went from Fez, where the conference was, just out. And I ended up in some gorgeous smaller towns. I met some fascinating people. I disconnected from my devices. So for the whole time, there was no internet or phone or anything that I had on me. And the experience was incredibly rewarding to travel in that way, where it's almost like somebody, you know, Marco Polo or somebody was traveling, you know, hundreds of years ago, where you're just fully in the place.
How did your thinking change during the time you transitioned from a fast to a slower-paced life?
Well, you know, what I found was the dominant qualities of our society are the fast qualities of, like, you know, agitated, hurried, rushed, stressed. And I found that during this experiment in slow living in Manhattan that I wrote about in New Slow City, we moved into a more state of, you know, relaxed, centered, those types of qualities. So Carlos Petrini, the guy who started slow food, basically said, you know, to always be slow is stupid. What we're talking about is the ability to control the pace of our own lives and find tempo gusto, which is the right pace in Italian, you know. So I guess what I found is, like, I was able to find more of a right pace. And it was a self-paced life. So instead of being controlled, and by the way, we live, as you know, in a system of real domination, you know, like, the Marxists used to talk about, like, exploitation of the working class and so on. But really, a lot of former Marxists came to see it as a system of domination, where 95% of GDP goes through major corporations who are setting the agenda of the texture of our lives through the conditioning that we receive from day one. So by having a slow life, you're kind of stepping out of that. You're finding, oh, wait a minute, I can create a self-paced lifestyle, which is more creative and fun and spontaneous and human. Because we're getting to the point on that fine line between humans and something that's not quite human in the sense of, like, you know, our species is Homo sapiens, connected with nature, connected with tribe and extended family and so on. We're getting to a point where we're becoming so hyper-individualistic and also so controlled by larger forces, part of very dominating corporate systems, that we're losing a lot of what it really is to be human. So in a deeper sense, slow does not just mean, you know, enjoying slow food and slow travel. It's also about a freedom.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is William Powers, author of the book New Slow City, Living Simply in the World's Fastest City. How would you respond to those who say that only the relatively privileged or well-off can consider living the slow life you describe?
Yeah, you know, in one sense, they're right. And I did find that to be absolutely true, that in 2015 America, to take the kind of decision that we took is a privileged position. It counted on us having a certain amount of savings and being of a kind of middle-class, professional class that you can earn a lot per hour. So it would be very difficult for somebody working at minimum wage to replicate what we did. However, even for folks who are at that space, you can think in terms of 5 to 10 years and investing in multiple income streams, investing in your own human capital and how you can uncinch yourself in the future from the work and spend treadmill. And also, anyone can practice these more meditative and more like just enjoyable practices in your day-to-day life. It doesn't take any money at all to go to an urban sanctuary or look up to the third story or so on. But on the other side of the question is, like, okay, each listener today should think about their own life, though, and where they are. And even if it's impossible for everyone to do it today, maybe if it's possible for you, you can take a certain amount of your time, even just 10%, and dedicate it towards the longer-term social change that we need. Because the first step is to kind of like find like self-paced life and happiness that's intrinsic and not extrinsic, not happiness that comes from like having to consume certain products or please peers or so on. So you find that intrinsic happiness. And then, in a sense, the social change begins to happen because we need policies like, you know, universal health care. So you're not having to be cinched to an employer. And by the way, every other industrialized country has it. We certainly could as well. We also need paternity leave. We're the only industrialized country with no maternity leave as well. Longer vacation time. You know, so these are the kinds of policies that we'll push for in higher minimum wage that will bring equity over the long term and will bring everybody into this other way of living.
What do you consider the main challenges you faced by being slow in the midst of fast?
Well, at first it was really difficult to go so countercultural. You know, I call it sort of counter-cyclical living. The crowds are going in one direction, you're kind of going in the other. For example, I was taking five-day weekends at the beginning, and the short line buses that were coming in from the commuter buses from outside of the city, I was going the opposite direction into Harriman State Park to camp and to just be in nature during the week. So obviously that's going to lead to an alienation. But then what happened was I just started to connect with cultural creatives in this new movement. And by the way, it's a movement that's growing. Like, I don't know if you heard that Sweden just moved to the six-hour workday. So what happened in Sweden was the big companies there were realizing, oh my gosh, we're getting more efficiency out of six-hour workdays than eight-hour workdays. They eliminated extraneous meetings, and they eliminated all like social media and stuff during work. So when you're there, you're working. But then they've been finding over the past couple of years that employees are much more productive when they have more time with their family and to do what they want, and they come to work for those 6 hours.
What do you consider the most important lessons you learned from your year in New York of living more simply and slower?
One definitely is to take technology fasts, or technology sabbaticals, you could say. So we can't be always connected to everything. It's impossible to maintain your sense of peace and so on. So definitely we've maintained over the long term the sense of like, you know, at 6 o'clock in the evening, the gadgets go off. And Sundays are, you know, tech sabbaticals. We're not connected on Sundays either. You know, and another lesson is just really how important it is to have a spiritual practice of some kind, whatever it is for you, because that's what allows you to find that being sense of life. That's really the most important thing, I think, is the inner sense of peace. I mean, like what Eckhart calls the now, the present moment. Like everything that's happening around us is happening in the space of now, all the busyness, all the work, all the craziness. But whatever's happening in that external space, you still have this total connection to everything. And if you can tap into that, and by the way, when you do, you are automatically going to be more productive and more successful in a sense because you found that sense of peace and creativity.
What was your experience of finding nature in the city?
Well, New York is nestled in a rich bioregion surrounded by mountains and some large rivers and oceans, the Atlantic Ocean and bays, the Long Island Sound and so on. So I just found myself connecting to what philosopher David Abram calls the more than human world. And everything from just noticing the red-tailed hawk that flies over Washington Square Park outside of our apartment to enjoying the way that, you know, if you discover your rooftop, like we discovered our rooftop, and we were the only ones in this whole year in this micro-apartment building that ever went up on the roof. We were up there every day. We watched baby pigeons be born in nests right on the fire escape across from the roof and then fledge and then fly away. So every day it was like this exciting way of connecting with nature. And dozens of bird species came through our little rooftop area throughout the year. So you're watching the seasons change from the roof. The other connection was, of course, taking the A train out to Rockaways and body surfing on a regular basis. You know, it's just like 45 minutes from downtown. And you're out in the ocean. There's dolphins. Regularly, pods of dolphins would swim by. You're in New York City and you're like swimming with dolphins on a Wednesday. So lots more connection. And the other one was camping more regularly. So all you need is a tent, you jump on the short line bus heading the other direction, and boom, you're out there in the forest. Sometimes my wife, Melissa, who, by the way, was working at the UN this whole time during the slow year experiment, she'd be out there, we'd camp, she'd get up at 6 o'clock and take the commuter bus in. They'd have no idea that she was been camping the night before. She's in her 17th story building on 34th Street.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I mean, what I've been finding in releasing the book around the country and just speaking to groups is that it definitely, on a deeper level, challenges. It's so countercultural, this idea. And I think what it's accomplishing is feeding these varied movements of slow food, slow travel, transition towns, eating local. It's sort of feeding that movement and just increasing this tribe of cultural creatives who are on the edge of a slower, saner world. Because we have to live this way. We have to find other ways. I mean, the revolution has to be irresistible. It can't be forced down from the top by any kind of ideology. It has to bubble up out of people's own creativity and joy and pleasure. And I think that's what this is really about. It's really a new edge of social change. Because why would you choose, in some ways, the work and spend treadmill, the 2 weeks off a year, the kind of taking Prozac, when you can choose something that's so much more self-paced and enjoyable and that really connects you to others in a real way outside of the commercial zone?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I just hope that listeners have absorbed some of the varied ideas that I brought up. Obviously, I'd love people to read New Slow City because that's where for like 15 hours they'll be sinking into people like Juliet Shore, the economist, and John McGrath, all the thinkers that I weave into this memoir. And what people find when they read the book is it's like it sort of creates another space or another way of thinking beyond the actual concepts and ideas. It's just like a way of living that then they can find their own slow. Because there's no one top-down thing. It's like for you in this fast-paced, crazy world that's changing in ways that we could never have imagined, how can you maintain your autonomy, your sense of peace, and be living towards a more future-fit world?
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks a lot, Diane. It's been great to be here.
You were just listening to William Powers, author of the book New Slow City, Living Simply in the World's Fastest City, published in 2014 by New World Library. For more information, check on the web at williampowersbooks.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.